About 10 years from now, I want to have plenty of time to go fishing. So I'm backing my future with United States Savings Bonds.
This is Milton Cross inviting you to hear the new Treasury Salute, presented on more than 800 American radio stations and featuring Robert Waldrop, author and commentator, and George Byron in a transcribed story from the American Notebook. Dear friend and gentle heart. Now, Robert Waldrop and our Treasury Salute story, Dear Friend and Gentle Heart.
They say he died a pauper's death in a charity ward at New York's Bellevue Hospital. They say they found him with his throat gashed open where he had fallen and cut it, against a broken wash basin, in a cheap room of a cheap lodging house in the Bowery. They say there were only a few cents in his pocket and a slip of paper on which he had scribbled the words, Dear Friends and Gentle Hearts. These things are all unfortunately true, but they do not do Stephen Foster justice. He was one of our greatest Americans. He died alone and almost friendless, but probably the last of the dear friends and gentle hearts in Foster's life was an Irish journalist named John Mayen, to whom we are indebted for this story of how he lived his last and how he died. In Windust's restaurant in Park Row one afternoon in 1861, John Mayen was standing at the bar with some fellow newspapermen when a short man, neatly dressed in a blue swallowtail coat and a high silk hat, stepped up and ordered his drink. As he turned to leave, the bartender leaned over to Mayen and whispered,
Mr. Mayen,
huh?
Do you know who that gentleman is?
No, Mr. Barry, I don't believe I do.
That is Mr. Stephen C. Foster, the great songwriter.
Is that so?
It is.
Mr. Foster, I beg your pardon, sir, I wonder if I might speak with you a moment.
Why, most certainly, sir. Whom do I have the honor of addressing?
John Mayen, sir, journalist. I wanted to tell you how much I admire your songs, ever since I first heard them while I was living in Greece.
Greece? Do they sing my songs, too, in Greece?
They do indeed, sir. Mr. Barry, ask Mr. Foster if he'd join me in another glass.
Yes, sir.
The usual, Mr. Foster.
Thank you.
You know, Mr. Foster, when I was living in Greece, I met an English family visiting there who had brought with them some of the latest songs from London. One of these was particularly striking, sung by the mother and her children. Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. One of your songs, Mr. Foster.
Oh, one I wrote many years ago, Mr. Mayen. I knew that the gold miners had taken it to California with them in the gold rush of 49, but I was not aware that it had sung its way as far as Greece. This is pleasant news.
My wife, too, is an admirer of your music. We'd be deeply honored if you'd permit us to entertain you in our home at 311 Henry Street.
The honor would be entirely mine, Mr. Mayen.
Good, we'll arrange it then. Mr. Barry, another round here for Mr. Foster and myself.
Aye, sir.
The Mayens and Foster became fast friends, and upon the departure of Mrs. Foster for her home in Pittsburgh, Stephen spent increasing amounts of his time with his newfound friends. Many of his last songs were composed at their piano, and at the marriage of their daughter, Foster sang, in what was still, by John Mahon's description, a sweet tenor voice. But the Mahons were often in as bad straits financially as Foster himself. One evening, Stephen and John, without a penny between them, were sitting together.
John, there is no time for me to write a new song if we're to eat tonight. But I have one song that was refused by my recent publishers, Firth and Pond. You take it around to Daly, your publishers, and take what you can get for it.
Mr. Daly, you should be proud, Stephen, to get a song from you. Do you think you can write it down from memory?
I think I can.
I remember the days of our youth and love, when we sat neath the green oak tree, when thy smiles were as bright as the skies above, and thy voice made music unto me. Nevermore will come.
Daly did publish the song, and temporarily at least, Stephen Foster was in funds again. But his almost continued financial embarrassment led him, shy, retiring man that he was, to withdraw more and more within himself. And although he and John Mahon went everywhere publicly together, Stephen most often chose to remain unknown, unrecognized. So a signal was arranged between them, calculated to spare Stephen's further embarrassment if there were those about whom he would rather not have aware of his identity. At such times, Stephen would gently clap his hands together three times, and then he would be simply introduced as Mr. Foster. But things looked up journalistically for John Mahon, and one evening he was sent to report on a temperance meeting in the Bowery. Foster went with him. Ironic as a temperance meeting was to his taste for intemperate things, and upon entering the hall, Stephen gave the usual sign.
Come in, Mr. Mahon, and your friend, too. Meeting is in full progress.
Mr. Walford, this is Mr. Foster. Mr. Walford's chairman and organizer of this meeting.
Good evening, sir.
We are about to have some singing, gentlemen. Won't you sit down and join us?
Oh, I'm sure Mr. Foster would rather sing standing up, Mr. Walford. Let me tell him who you are, Stephen.
All right. It will do no harm.
How is that again, Mr. Mahon?
Mr. Walford, this is the famous Stephen Foster, the songwriter. I have no doubt that he could be prevailed upon to render one of his songs for you and the others here if you were but to ask him.
Stephen Foster? Indeed. Well, that would be a pleasure. Would you consent to sing, Mr. Foster?
Oh, I should be glad to oblige, Mr. Walford. You will show me to the piano, please. May I ask, however, that you not introduce me until I have sung?
Stephen Foster sang, and telling about it later, Mahon relates the demonstration that followed.
One moment of silence, amounting almost to astonishment, ensued. Then such a deafening cheer arose from both men and women as my pen can't describe. Handkerchiefs waved and cheer followed cheer, while the numbers who rushed to grasp him by the hand seemed to embarrass him considerably. It was, in fact, a perfect ovation. And although the people were all temperate, I believe that something stronger than lemonade was improvised for Foster and myself.
It was John Mahon who, in the end, gave Foster the money with which to pay for his bed and room at the old New England Hotel in the Bowery, where his untimely accident occurred. On the 13th of January, 1864, Mahon, having lost his wife in death, was himself a paying patient at Bellevue when the bleeding body of Stephen Foster was admitted there into one of the charity wards where he died. Mahon himself was unaware of it until he read the accounts in the newspapers. But Stephen Foster's life did not really end on that miserable note of despair and misfortune. He had written and sung too many happier, sweeter notes so to leave himself to posterity. Though he did die far from his own old folks at home, his words and his simple melodies are enshrined now even more than then in homes everywhere, not only in this country but abroad, though his songs are nothing if not purely American. At a time when the only culture to be had in this land was imported from the capitals of Europe, Stephen Foster found and brought to light a culture that sprang from his native soil. That was what made him great. He sang of the common, everyday things, for Stephen Foster was a common, everyday man. The only uncommon thing about him was he was a dreamer, a beautiful dreamer. He took his songs from the tented revival meeting, the gas-lit minstrel show, the dusky riverlands of the South. He sensed the aspirations of the simplest soul and lifted it up. He sensed the greatness of America and expressed it in his songs. He sensed it in the little things and he extolled them. Because Stephen Foster was the first great American composer, and because he cherished this same land we all love, and because he gave us one of our richest heritages, because the little clapping of his hands to signal his anonymity has mounted to the highest applause that we, as richer, happier, more fortunate Americans, can give him, he has become the dearest friend, the gentlest heart, in all of our American notebook.
Friends, this is Milton Cross speaking. The wonderful music of Stephen Foster that has been handed down to us of this generation is but one of the thousands upon thousands of things that are ours and that have cost us not one cent nor one moment of work or thought. We, the people of the United States, have inherited the richest, most powerful nation in all the world. To keep it that way, we must each now work and plan for the future. The best way to build financial security is to invest regularly in United States savings bonds. Not only do they pay you back $4 for every three in just 10 years, but they're backed by your government. It's up to you to take care of this matter for yourself. So start backing your future now with United States savings bonds. They are always conveniently available at banks, post offices, and on the payroll savings plan where you work. Financially secure individual Americans are the key to a strong America, and a strong America can lead the world to peace and prosperity.
Our next Treasury Salute story from the American Notebook will be called Playing with Fire. I'm sure you'll enjoy it, so join us, won't you? Until then, this is Robert Waldrop speaking. Thank you for listening.
The United States Treasury thanks George Byron and the other distinguished artists who appeared on this transcribed program. The Treasury Salute was written and narrated by Robert Waldrop and directed by William S. Rainey. The music was under the direction of Mark Warnow. This is Milton Cross reminding you that the best way in the world to back your future is to keep buying and holding United States savings bonds.